This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that lets you accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wired news. Coming up today, why online pornography ended up in the Queen's speech, how Iraq shut down the internet to stop students cheating at exams, and we go inside the weird world of co-living. You're listening to episode 268 of the YGK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Emily Reynolds.
Hello.
And Matt Burgess.
Hello.
Now, in the week where, confusingly, Nokia sort of bought back the right to make Nokia phones and tablets from Microsoft, bit of a strange deal, you can read about it on YGK, it got me thinking. What was your first mobile phone, Matt?
Mine was an Alcatel, which actually had changeable covers, and I think I changed it every couple of days just to make myself think that I was cool.
Oh, yeah? So you went into the phone shop and bought new covers so you could style your phone to your dress sense?
I'm not going to admit to that on the podcast.
Emily, what was your first phone?
Mine was a Nokia 3310, which I attempted to break constantly so I could get a new and better phone, but they're unbreakable, completely unbreakable.
And also the phone that nearly everyone had.
Yeah.
How good did you get at Snake?
Really, really good.
Like, good enough so that the
entire Snake... I reckon I could
probably
still participate in kind of world championships of Snake.
I'm willing to believe that. My first one, I can't remember the name of it, but it was a tiny little Sony flip phone, a grey thing with a pull-up aerial. And you don't really get flip phones anymore. I liked them.
I feel like hanging up on someone with a flip phone is much more satisfying than just pressing end call.
Yeah, especially when you get sort of your wrist, like the flip,
exactly.
Right? So you can, do it all in one smooth motion. All right, a thing that you've learnt this week. Matt, you start.
I've learnt that the first robot, which actually carries a gun, a small robot this is, has been created by a company in Israel.
Why?
For military uses, but it's just quite scary that this little robot, which is smaller than a dog, smaller than a small dog even, carries around a little Glock pistol inside of it and can shoot people, which is a bit...
dystopian.
Yeah, and I see here in your notes it can also climb stairs.
It can.
Which you normally think, well, I'll be able to get away by going up the stairs, but you can't.
I mean, you could just turn your back, going around the other side of it so the gun's not facing you.
But... climb a tree.
Yep, good. Emily, what did you learn this week?
I learned what percentage of the emails sent every day are considered spam, so I'm going to ask you to guess. So around 60 billion emails are sent every day. What percentage of them are spam?
Judging by my inbox, I'm going to say 72%.
40?
It's actually 97% of all emails sent every day are spam.
That's extraordinary.
Most of them are sent by Matt Burgess.
Yeah. And you get used to not seeing them because email clients are good at hiding them now.
Yeah.
But every time you go into, I have Gmail, you go into the junk folder there and it's just a sea
thousands
of Canadian
thousands,
pharmaceutical
yeah.
companies, which are irrelevant to us. Okay, I learned that Italian Emma Morano, born on November 29th, 1899, is now the last living person that we know of who is officially recognised to have been born in the 1800s.
How old does that actually make her?
116, so she'll be 117 this November. And Morano attributes her longevity to eating 3 eggs a day, 2 of them raw, and to remaining single most of her life.
So it's there's a life philosophy to live by, I think.
Eggs and singledom.
Yep.
Our first story this week concerns pornography. In the Queen's speech earlier this week, the Queen said that her government would ensure that all sites containing pornographic material be hidden behind age verification blocks. Strange thing for the Queen to say. The forthcoming digital economy bill will argue that all sites containing any pornographic material must be hidden unless a user can prove they are over 18. No further details of how the blocks will be implemented or enforced have been announced. But Matt, you've reported on this before. This isn't new news.
No, it's not brand new, but it's been confirmed in the Queen's speech, which for those people who aren't in the UK, the Queen's speech is a big pompous ceremony that takes place once a year when the Parliament reopens and the Queen basically reads out what the government's plans are for the forthcoming 12 months for new laws. And this law for around pornography is actually included in this new bill, which is going to be looking at all the digital areas of the government and what we do.
And it goes back to the Conservative Party's election manifesto, where they included a pledge to improve protection for children online. And it's part of an even wider campaign by the Conservative government to introduce tools and means of hiding pornography from those that the Conservatives argue shouldn't see it. So in February of this year, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport said that commercial providers of pornography should have age verification controls to stop under 18s from viewing inappropriate material. And what the Queen said in the Queen's speech earlier this week was that that's still very much ongoing and is something that the government still plans to introduce.
And this sounds like the sort of thing that not everybody is going to be happy with.
Yeah, so there's an issue with censorship here and controlling what information people are able to see, and also an issue with how you're going to adequately introduce systems that stop people getting to pornography. So if you decide to block it, that's one issue, but then how you block it? So one critic a few months ago when we were covering this story earlier on in its cycle said that web-savvy teens would be able to get around any measures introduced. So we already have similar systems on an ISP level, so the likes of BT, Virgin Media and Sky will use ISP level adult content filters. These are essentially parental controls, but these can be dodged using basic techniques such as VPNs or even oddly Google Translate.
And as I understand it, this new bill for this is going to actually introduce verification, which means that people are going to have to prove that they are over 18. And as far as I'm aware, there's a system like this already involved for gambling. So people have to have credit cards and have to enter their credit card details, even if they're not paying for anything, although you obviously would be with gambling, to show that you're old enough to have a credit card and thus to gamble or, in the future, watch porn online.
Yeah, and it's likely that a similar kind of system would be introduced. They've kind of batted around various ideas of, well, how do you prove that someone's 18? You could use maybe their NHS number or their national insurance number. I'm not sure if that's tied to age. And then you have the problem of everyone that goes on any pornographic website would have to enter their credit card information to view that. And then you essentially have a huge database of every pornographic website that the person that owns that credit card has visited. So it's problematic. But as I said, there's already similar-ish systems in place. So in July 2013, Prime Minister David Cameron announced a scheme that would require all internet service providers in the UK to ask their customers if they wanted adult content web filters turned on or off. Most ISPs have now made that a default option. So you have to opt out of having these filters turned on. And most people maybe wouldn't realize until they go to search for something that's considered adult. And it might not be pornography. It might be something to do with violence or sexual health or suicide, for example. And all of a sudden, you'll find out that your ISP won't let you look at it unless you can get the permission of the bill payer to turn the feature off.
Which is often problematic because I remember at the time there was lots of LGBT charities, their websites were blocked, and obviously if teenagers are trying to access these kind of services, they're not going to want to ask their parents to turn the filter off. So it's obviously making people unable to access content that's not necessarily pornographic, but it's considered adult.
Yeah, and there's another problem with the escalation of this, and I'd be interested to hear what the two of you think about it. How do you prove what is pornographic and what isn't? And then what happens if a website says no, we're not going to introduce these age verifications? So you've got an issue whereby, and this is something that alternative pornographers have argued, kind of homebrew pornography, if that's the right term, have said that, well, it's fine for really big pornographic companies, but for little people, it's really expensive to implement. So my question is this just going to make porn really bland?
And it also, I think it comes down to what you consider a porn website as well. For example, if you take Tumblr or even Twitter, there's a lot of pornographic content on these websites, amateur stuff, videos, GIFs people that have uploaded. And does that make this a porn website? Is Tumblr, in the government's eyes, considered to be hosting pornography? Should this people have to prove that they're old enough to actually be able to use Tumblr or Twitter or any other website, forums, things like this that aren't specifically all their content is porn? So where do we draw that line?
Yeah.
Especially as lots of those websites are mainly populated by people who aren't adults. You know, Tumblr is popularly used by teenagers predominantly, so...
Yeah, it's a really, really complicated issue, and one that the government's butted up against a number of times with its previous legislation. And this escalation of it is going to see more debate, and they're going to hit against the same technical problems that they had before, but it's going to be way more controversial because all of a sudden you'll have to prove who you are. to access sites that have been deemed to be adult. Matt, our second story this week is equally serious and is all to do with a far greater form of censorship in Iraq.
So last week in Iraq, the internet was actually not blocked. It was completely turned off. In this country, we pretty much take it for granted that if our router goes down or our internet goes down, that it's probably just a temporary thing. And we don't expect that it's been actually initiated by the government. But that was actually the case in Iraq. And the reason for them doing this was because students were sitting their exams.
What? This is really, really weird. And they turned it on for specific amounts of time, right?
Yeah, so the internet was turned off between 5 a.m. and 8 a.m. across three different days earlier this week and slightly into last week as well. And this is why these exam periods were going on. And the theory behind it is so that students can't cheat.
And these aren't university students. These are kids.
Yeah, these are a lot younger kids. They're sort of your middle school in this country, that sort of age. Who are doing sort of early on exams. They're important exams in the country, but they are still fairly young, not really sophisticated, not university level exams. And yeah, the rationale behind turning the internet off was so that they don't cheat, so they don't go online, so they don't share information between each other. And yeah, that's pretty severe.
Yeah, and it's so severe that it went to the extent that not just your home broadband connections were shut down, it was also mobile broadband as well, so you couldn't even get it on your phone.
Yeah, that was the case. The government actually issued messages to service providers of mobile data and said that they should turn off this capacity. There was one researcher in the country who actually tweeted that about they received a text message from their actual service provider saying the internet's going to be off between these times.
Yeah. So how did they do it? It would be almost impossible to do it in the UK, but in Iraq, there's a fairly unique set of circumstances that meant this was possible.
Yeah, it can be relatively straightforward for them to actually turn off the internet in Iraq. It happened last year as well, around the same time. But this is because there is a fiber optic backbone that runs throughout the country. So there is basically one big network of cables that runs throughout the country, and the network is owned and controlled by the Ministry of Communications. So basically all of the internet there and all of the ISPs who provide the internet and also mobile providers are controlled by the Iraqi Ministry of Communications.
So how common is this, wider across the world? Is this the kind of thing that happens a lot?
So we're basically talking about censorship here. In this case with Iraq, it's on a very specific time for a very specific reason, but it's still censorship because anybody else around the world, in Iraq, who was trying to do anything online during these times would obviously not be able to do so. So if you think of China, there's a lot of censorship there and it can be done in many different ways. But the Iraq case, because it was a blanket ban, that makes it fairly unique. And I was speaking to Oliver Farnham, a researcher from the University of Oxford, and he said that the most common sort of censorship that happens is very targeted. It's normally for political reasons. It's normally done by blocking an IP address. So even in the UK, if you think about, maybe censorship isn't the correct word, but we have websites that are piracy websites where people can download, so they're blocked at an IP level in this country.
Yeah. And is it less controversial to just turn off the internet than it is to specifically target individual websites and topics with an agenda? So we were just talking about hiding adult content in the UK behind an age verification block. Is that worse than turning off the whole internet or better?
Well, that depends on your political standpoint, really. Civil liberties groups have been complaining, and they did so last year, about the internet being turned off because it stops people from communicating. And if you're going to do it for one thing, such as exams, then where do you draw this line? Personally, I think that it should never be turned off, and people should be able to freely communicate, and the government shouldn't be controlling a centralized internet system. But I guess it comes down to where you draw lines, if you think that this is appropriate or not.
Yeah. And it would be more or less impossible for this to happen in the UK because of our infrastructure.
Yeah, it pretty much was. Because in Iraq, as I've mentioned just earlier, the internet systems and the fiber optic systems are all controlled by the government there. And in the UK, it's slightly different. We have different providers. We have different networks running throughout the country. So you couldn't really just turn a network off in that respect.
And it's strange to me that you can just turn it off, but you can. When I asked you to start researching this story, I wanted the technical explanation of how it was done, and I said, "Don't come back with an answer. You just unplug a cable or turn off a router." But that's the answer. That's how it was done.
Yeah, that's pretty much. There are a couple of different ways that can do it, but the most basic way that you can turn off an internet for a whole system or a whole country is by unplugging a router or and taking cables out of there, and that'll obviously drop the internet across in pretty much seconds. It'll go straight away. But it's also possible to reroute the internet connection throughout the country to say that it comes, so the signal comes back with saying there is no endpoint. It can't find Facebook, basically. So if you try to connect to Facebook, the signal will be sent out. It will come back and say there isn't Facebook here. It doesn't actually exist in as the internet can see it.
Yeah, and there's been some weird cases in the past. I think in 2008, Pakistan tried to do something to block YouTube and ended up knocking it offline for the entire world.
They did. And also in 2012, I think it was, there was a case in where the NSA in America, and this came out from Edward Snowden in an interview with Wired in the US, the NSA were trying to look at a router in Syria to basically do whatever they were doing in terms of monitoring communications there, and they accidentally made it inoperable. They made it so it couldn't work, and they knocked out the whole internet for the whole of Syria for a brief while until they fixed this router. So that was done remotely.
So given the totality of the blocks, was there any way for people in Iraq to get online during this time?
Pretty much no, but if you lived in a region, the northern region of Kurdistan, that actually has a slightly different system because of the way that the country is set up. It's autonomous, it's got its own government, that regional government that very much controls what goes on in the area, and it also has some of the main internet connection routes out of Iraq to Turkey and to Iran. So that's slightly different in that respect. Some people there would have had a bit of coverage, and probably more likely they would have had some mobile coverage as well. But for people living in other areas of Iraq, it's probably unlikely unless they had their own satellite system.
Which is obviously somewhat expensive and quite an elaborate way of getting around blocks, so not a lot of people were likely to have done it. Emily, magic mushrooms. You've been looking into an interesting story around how they could treat depression this week.
Yes, so a very small-scale study has suggested this week that psilocybin, which is a psychedelic compound in magic mushrooms, could actually be used to treat severe depression.
Okay, so you say a small-scale study. How small are we talking?
It was actually very small. It was 12 people, 6 men and 6 women, all of whom had treatment-resistant depression. So basically that means these people had taken lots of different courses of antidepressants, they'd had therapy, and nothing was actually working.
Okay, so they were given a dose of magic mushrooms.
Well, they were more accurately, they were given 2 doses a week apart of psilocybin, which is the compound in magic mushrooms, in capsules, and then their moods were monitored, obviously, before and afterwards.
And what happened once they'd been given these doses?
Well, the patients actually showed a decrease in symptoms for at least 3 weeks after they'd taken the dosage. And 7 of them actually continue to show this kind of positive response for 3 months, which is obviously quite significant. And also they all reported, you know, feeling more pleasant and having kind of pleasurable, some of them described it as beautiful experiences. So,
and this isn't the only trial that we've had recently that looks at what we consider recreational drugs and how they could be used to treat mental health problems.
Yeah, so there was a study, I think it was last week or the week before, that sought to understand what the antidepressant effect of ketamine was, which has long been kind of known to be an antidepressant in small doses, but no one really understood why or what was happening kind of scientifically. And the study found that it was the metabolic breakdown of ketamine in the human body, the byproduct of that is what was causing antidepressant effects. Also, there was a study that was reported quite widely about LSD and the areas of the brain that were activated when people were on LSD. So there's lots of research going on at the moment into this kind of what we would consider recreational drugs.
And we had one of the researchers from the LSD study on the Wired UK podcast a few weeks back, and his point was that it was now much easier to trial these kind of drugs on very, very targeted groups of people and to get very good results that were academically rigorous.
Yeah, although it is important to note that obviously with the psychoactive substances bill, there's a kind of flip side to that in that the research that's been going on into things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's that had been taking place with kind of legal highs are now being obstructed. So there are kind of 2 sides to the story on this one.
Yeah, and there's been calls for more of this kind of research to go on so that the mental health industry is less reliant on pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, so David Nutt, who was involved in the study on LSD and also in the magic mushroom study, he's been really outspoken about kind of recreational drugs and legal highs and what kind of research we should be doing around drugs. He stressed that it was incredibly important that academic research groups were allowed to kind of develop this kind of research and try to develop treatments that aren't linked to the pharmaceutical industry, which he says is kind of lagging behind in terms of research.
Okay, so still to come. In San Francisco, New York and London, businesses such as Pure House and WeWork are offering modern nomads the opportunity to easily set up home in a new city. For a flat monthly rate, you get a bedroom, bathroom, kitchen and linen, with all utilities included. And perhaps most importantly, you also get access to a community. But is this just Silicon Valley giving a fancy name to shared housing? We'll try and unpick the latest sharing economy phenomenon after this.
Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Everything from Paysos to PayPal to Apple Pay to whatever comes next. Braintree's simple, flexible SDKs make your job and payments easier. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/wirednews.
Welcome back. At this point in the show, we'll say goodbye to Matt Burgess.
Goodbye.
And hello to Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
Now, if you're on Spotify, you no longer own any music. Subscribe to Netflix, you probably don't own any films or TV shows. Use Uber or Zipcar, you no longer own a car. Now, Co-Living wants to turn housing itself into a service. Roland, you have co-lived. But
indeed.
What is it?
Well, the idea behind co-living is very similar to co-working. So you buy a big house, you split it up into rooms, and then because you're sharing, you can have nicer facilities, you can have a bigger shared space. You can have all the things that you want, but you can't afford because you live on your own.
But you don't own any of them. You pay a subscription, effectively, to live.
Yes, and so you pay month by month.
Mm-hmm.
So and, like a house share.
You could say, in fact, it's exactly like a house share.
But, I mean, we've all probably lived in shared houses at university. I lived in a house of 8 or 9 people. That's pretty common. But what we're seeing now is it happening on way bigger scales. It's been Silicon Valley'd.
Exactly. And so companies are investing a lot of money in this. And the idea is to try and do it at gigantic scale. And I guess not just for students, but for adults. So there's a company called Common, which has raised a bit over $7 million. And I guess the thing that's really attracting a lot of attention is WeWork, which is the biggest co-working company in the world. They've just launched their new thing called WeLive, and they have a serious amount of money behind this.
So the idea would be that they would buy up huge, huge properties and massive portfolios and fill them up with sort of younger adults?
Exactly. And it's not just an idea. They are doing it. And earlier this year, I went to visit the WeWork and also stay for a while in Pure House, which is a smaller version of this co-living idea.
Okay, so Pure House is in New York. Tell us about what you got up to while you were there and what it was like.
Well, so Pure House is in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, which is the trendy part of New York. And, I mean, I didn't really get up to a great deal in a way because it was very normal. It was just like a shared house. I hung out. I slept in a room with 3 other guys. And we all had, it was a big room subdivided into little bits. So and I had one room in there, and it felt pretty ordinary.
So how does it, because Emily, you've brought up the point and we've said it a couple of times now, shared housing. Is the only difference here scale and that there are big companies involved and a lot of venture capital money behind it?
Yeah, so I guess that's the main difference. That sounds like, oh, that's the only difference. But of course, that's gigantic, isn't it? The fact that you're taking this from an ad hoc thing which you kind of have to organise yourself to something which you can just opt into, just in the same way that you want a car, you don't have one, well, you get a zip car. And also, I guess the difference is that shared houses, you're always kind of organising them yourselves. In fact, that's kind of what makes them a bit of a pain. So with this, they organise everything for you. Everything is laid on. You have your linen changed. You have all the cleaning products are in a cupboard. Even the community is selected. And this is kind of one of the interesting things about it. They operate a process of curation. So you have to apply to be in there, and then if you're selected, then you stay, and you can kind of, you get the community as part of the package. So you have the right people with you.
Well, this is one of my kind of problems with it, in that I've read quite a lot of articles that have said, you know, it's kind of like the future of housing and it might, you know, help alleviate the housing crisis. But I think that that approach is kind of a very, very idealistic look at the housing crisis, which is actually a very real problem that affects people who aren't just middle class app developers, for example. You know, the people that are hit by the housing crisis are kind of marginalized families and poor people. And I just don't really understand how this kind of way of living it, and the kind of lifestyle that they promote could actually be a practical solution to lots of very real problems around housing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole thing, could it solve the housing crisis? This is a pretty kind of futuristic scenario. I guess that, I mean, so when I went out there, yeah, I thought, okay, right, so I'm going out to see a big shared house. What is different or kind of interesting about this? But then I met so many people who just told me stories like, so there was this woman who worked for the Clinton campaign. So she was living in, I can't remember exactly where, in another city in the US. And she had to move to New York extremely quickly to do this really difficult, high-pressure job. She was living in Brooklyn. And so her options were, so right, you get, what do you do? Like, you get a hotel that's going to be insanely expensive. Same with Airbnb. So you can stay on someone else's sofa. I mean, with that, and then that's, you know, not very easy because you've got, you know, you've got this job you've got to go into in the morning and you need to start immediately. And so she, like lots of other people, told me, well, I moved in an Uber. I didn't really have many possessions. I just got into a taxi and then I was able to fly over and then just move straight in. Everything was organized for me. Plus, I had these other people and I didn't really know anyone in the city.
Yeah. And are the people involved in this, to go back to Emily's question, are they purporting to be solving the housing crisis, or do they just see it as part of how we'll start living in cities in the future?
A bit of both. So the eventual vision is that, and this is what you're talking about when you talk about housing as a service, is that we wouldn't own property. There would be a platform, essentially. It's kind of property as a platform, and you pay in, you opt in, and we're all kind of moving around, I suppose, like taxis on the Uber app.
And there are some people involved in this movement that would see it go even further than that, that you would just flat out not really own anything. You would subscribe to clothes, you would subscribe to grocery deliveries, you would subscribe to furniture, and it would all be provided to you as a service. Your life would, in essence, become a series of subscriptions.
Exactly. And there's even the possibility that one of some of the people talk about is that you wouldn't even necessarily have to pay for this stuff. It would be just like Spotify. You'd be living in your small flat, and because you're there, you're able to be marketed to by brands, and you can give up your data in exchange for living. So they're saying we're essentially providing accommodation for free.
But does that not in itself kind of contradict the sense of community that they're trying to foster? Like, often a sense of community is built up over quite a long time. For example, where my mum lives, there's like a very strong sense of community because there are people who have lived there for a long time, and you know, it takes a while to foster relationships and like come together as a group of people. If everyone's living this kind of nomadic lifestyle, then there's not really the chance to kind of combat things like urban loneliness and things which are quite kind of profound problems that people experience.
So I take it your mum lives London, New York?
London.
Okay, yeah. So like what area of London? She lives in a particular
South
area
London.
Of London.
South London.
Yeah, I mean, because I feel like this is very much kind of catered towards a certain vision of life where you're moving around a lot.
But lots of people don't want to do that. So it's, I mean, how large scale do they want it to be?
I don't know. I can't imagine it being this being for everyone. And one of the interesting things that I noticed when I was there, I mean, you know, I thought it was a good idea, actually. And I thought that it was for some people, it was really solving a genuine problem. So there's on one side, you've got the solving the practical problem stuff. But there is also this vision of a life lived lightly, is how some people put it. So you don't have any property, you don't have any really fixed ties, you're not in a relationship. And I mean, I found that in some ways quite a strange vision of life. And the one thing that you really noticed in these places is that everyone was from a certain age bracket. There weren't children, there weren't older people.
So it's not really a community.
Yes, it's well, I mean, I don't know, it's hard. When you see these people, they are really getting on and they're spending time together and they're enjoying their company. But that is a community of some sorts.
Feel like there's a very distinct difference between sharing a physical space with someone and having a community in that sense and actually having a genuine community. I think obviously anyone who's lived in university halls could probably attest to that. There is a sense of community because you're sharing the same space, but that doesn't necessarily have any kind of beneficial psychological impact on you, or any, there's not necessarily anything inherently good about sharing space with those people.
And let's take a look at co-living in the wider community and what impact that might have. So you can read Roland's article about co-living in the latest issue of Wired magazine, and it's also online, so you can find it there. And there was one bit of your story that really, really got me. You were talking about a Super Bowl party, and after the party had finished, everyone went out into the garden.
Yeah.
And there's a fence, and you make a very strong point of this. There is a very high fence, and you can't see anything outside. The community is within those walls. It's segregated.
And that place that I was talking about, that's opposite a housing shelter. But then I think that, I mean, this is what's so interesting, is that when you go and spend time with people who are living there and you see it for yourself, is that all the people there said to me, oh yeah, I feel really awkward and difficult about this. It's a real problem. I don't know what to do about it. I mean, and I understood that. It's, in a way, what we're talking about is kind of such a big intractable problem.
The word we're grasping for here is gentrification.
Yes, of course, exactly.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and this is going to be coming to London. So can you tell us a bit about the development that's being built right now?
Oh, well, in fact, it's been built. It's in Old Oak, which is near Willesden Junction in North West London, and it's the biggest co-living place in the world. It's 550 rooms. It opened half opened in May, but it's going to open fully in September, and it is gigantic.
So 550 rooms, and there's space for 400 and so people to do co-working as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, yeah. So, and this has been set up by a company called The Collective, who do co-working and also kind of more traditional accommodation. And I mean, I went around it when it was a building site earlier this year, and you go into the co-working space and you cannot believe how big this room is. It is just gigantic. And then upstairs, the corridors, I mean, we just carried on going upstairs and stairs and stairs. And the way that the corridors, you stand them and there'd be these endless corridors with rooms coming off them. The ambition of it is quite terrifying. And
so it's kind of like a high-rise.
Yeah, it's a co-living tower block. And, I mean, these guys, they're really going for this.
And this is expensive. They haven't said how much it's cost to make, but it's tens of millions.
Tens of millions was the quote that they gave me.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the guy who set it up is... he took out, I think it was £1 million loan on his parents' house to get his business started. So,
and it's been building bigger and bigger projects ever since.
Exactly, and now they're kind of getting into this co-living thing. But I mean, and that was kind of in a way like quite kind of dystopian place I found, because so you have this small room, not much bigger than the cupboard in which we're standing, and there are two people living in that, and you get basically a bed. There's no room for storage. And then there's a little lobby out the front where there's a tiny desk, you couldn't really sit on it to work, and a mirror, and a shared bathroom. And then you've got just so many of those replicated again and again and again.
But it does sound like student halls.
Yeah, well, I mean, but then, you know, lots of people might think, well, I can identify with that, the thing that weird way that you stop making friends after you leave university because you go into your kind of more isolated, quote-unquote, adult way of living.
Isn't that a bit weird, that you live in these communities at university and everyone, not everyone, but people will often say that university was the best time of their life for various reasons, right? And for me, a big part of that was the community in which
exactly,
I lived.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't enjoy university probably for the same reason, because of the community.
So there are people that are very relieved to go off into what you said, Roland, was an adult life, but there's maybe an oddness there that you leave university and then you all start living in semi-detached houses.
But is co-working not like a good medium for that? Because when I went to Berlin a few weeks ago, I worked in a co-working space with one of my friends who lives there. And it was kind of like the way that you described, the way that people were talking about their ideas. And like, it was a really great place for kind of intellectual discussion and meeting new and interesting people. But also we weren't sharing a bathroom or, you know, using the same towels. So it seems like that kind of thing might be a more practical way of kind of introducing this kind of lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, but then... So what you're describing with co-working is that thing that, yeah, all the shared facilities are great, but it's that aspect of having the other people around. And maybe it wouldn't be for everyone, but you can see it worked for co-working. And then I really think that this is real, that we are going to see these all over the place. But again, say like with co-working began as this very idealistic thing of, oh, we're going to open up our spaces and we'll have people working in there and it'll just be about sharing. And like so many sharing economy things, it's become pretty industrial, pretty like a sort of new version of of the kind of old rented office space.
As anything at scale kind of tends towards, it becomes not utilitarian, but there are certain limitations of fitting 500 rooms in a tower block. It's going to feel like 500 rooms in a tower block.
Yeah, that was my takeout. Although, of course, I mean, all these guys who are setting these things up, they say, well, we want it to feel like home. It's your home. It's your place.
But the home is the communal spaces. That's very clear.
Isn't the home meant to be kind of the sense of community rather than the physical space?
So, yeah. And I mean, although some of them have nicer rooms where you can actually spend time. But in a way that, like, so, yeah, Reza, who the guy who runs the collective, he's like, yeah, your room is your crash pad and you just sleep there. And then you're hanging out all the rest of the time in the communal space, in brackets implied. And if you don't, you're a loser.
Yeah, and for some people that will sound like paradise, and for some people that will sound like a nightmare. Emily, I can sense your scepticism to this.
I'm sceptical of this, yeah.
Roland, I'd be interested, before you went and co-lived for 6 days in New York and spent a lot of time researching and speaking to the people that are financing it and living it, how has your perception of it changed, or has it changed?
No, it really has, actually. It was a really interesting, powerful experience. And it did make me think a lot about my own lifestyle and the way that, you know, I live with my partner and in our flat, and it's true that we don't know that many people who live in the block. And it did make me think, well, I mean, say, you know, looking forward, it would be quite nice to live in a more communal way, but also that I didn't want to adopt this whole lifestyle. I liked having a lot of the security that comes with more permanent arrangements.
Owning things. Yeah. Not necessarily the property, but the bookcase and the coffee table and the sofa.
It gives you like a sense of grounding, doesn't it, in your own life? Like, if say you have a bad day at work, you go home and it's like a safe place where you can go. I don't know whether you can necessarily guarantee that if it's full of other people.
Yeah, it's also this vision of a life of constant movement. I think I said in the piece that that a lot of these spaces, they're kind of all their messaging about community. And they say they're designed to cure urban loneliness. But somehow the vision of these mobile individuals constantly shifting around on this platform seemed so impossibly lonely and so inimical to, for example, having kids. I mean, how would you manage to have children in an atmosphere like that?
Yeah, or having older people around. You know,
exactly.
It's a real community is people of all creeds, colours and ages.
Yes, and which kind of feels really, really important. But then at the same time, I live next to people like that, people with kids and older people, but I don't really interact with them, and I would like to be able to.
See, I think it's about kind of getting initiatives or somehow creating communities like that where you live, because the building that I live in, I do know lots of the people who live in my building, and I know the couple that lives next door, and there's a woman that lives downstairs, and there's lots of people who I know in the building. And that's because people who live there kind of make a definite conscious effort to, you know, communicate with one another and befriend one another and come round when someone new moves in and things like that. And it definitely does make you feel less lonely, because I live completely on my own, and it's nice to know that there are people who live near me who, you know, I would consider friends. I don't necessarily think sharing a physical space with them is a good idea or the solution, or a solution to anything really, other than a temporary solution for people who maybe are moving around or need a short-term solution or want to make friends in a new city.
So at this point, I'd like to ask a very specific question. Would you co-live for a period of time or a long period of time?
Yes.
Emily?
I think I would probably go if I was moving to a new city, maybe, but otherwise, absolutely not.
I think similar. I'd give it a go. It could be a really useful way to introduce yourself to a city, but I'm not sure if that addresses the problem of urban loneliness, because then you're just sort of strangers passing in the night. You go in and then you come out again and you don't really make a connection with anyone. It's still transient.
I feel at some point there you started talking about work. Are we really just strangers in the night, James?
We totally are, yeah.
I knew it.
I could turn off the lights. I won't. So you can read Roland's article, as I said, in the latest issue of Wired magazine and online. And we'd be really interested to know what you think. This has definitely got us debating. So you can get Roland on Twitter.
Oh, you're pointing at me to say my Twitter handle.
I am.
It's at Rolls Mountthorpe. And please do let me know. I'm so fascinated to know what everyone would think about this.
Emily, on Twitter you are?
Razy, R-E-Y _Z. I say it every week and it doesn't get any less embarrassing.
There it is. And I am at Jay Temperton.
Less embarrassing.
Yes. That's the Wired UK podcast for this week. See you next week. Bye-bye.